Sonicsopoly, Sonicsopoly, which Dr. San offers through his Radio Liberty Ministry. And by the way, you can reach them at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for his various sets of books, tapes, many of them concerning terrorism, some of them probably including Craig Wynn's material.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And well, this evening, we're going to have Myrna Culbraith interviewing Craig Wynn, author of two books. One is Tea with Terrorists, and the other is The Prophet of Doom. But my voice will not hold out for the full time. So, Myrna, with that as a background, why don't you just take over?
Yes, absolutely, Dr. Stan. And you let the voice rest a little bit. Chime in whenever you'd like to. And Mr. Wynn, are you on the line with us? Let's do a little introduction. Two very interesting sounding titles, and Tea with Terrorists. How did that come about?
Well, Myrna, I'm on the morning.
I'm a little bit more volume, if you can.
Sure. On the morning of 9/11, I decided that somebody had better figure out why the terrorists wanted to kill us. We have done everything we can to not answer that question as a country, and I was convinced that we would make the same mistake that we typically make on almost every major issue with the mainstream media and with our politicians. So I felt that the smartest thing I could do was to find out directly. So I went to Ground Zero for suicide bombers worldwide, which is the West Bank. And that's all 9/11 really was a giant suicide bomb. And after 10 days of meeting with Palestinian Authority ministers and Knesset ministers and Assad agents, Shin Bet agents, and the like, I was able to broker a series of meetings with Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Oscar Martyrs Brigade, and was able to ask them why they killed us and why they hated both Americans and Jews. And what they told me was shocking. It's the opposite of what we report in our media.
What an astounding journey that you would, A, have the nerve and the courage to do that, and B, that you would think of doing it in the first place. Not everybody would tackle that kind of question, and not everybody would put themselves out on the line. So what is it that they, in a nutshell, or at any length, if you like, told you was their reason?
Well, first, I think there's a whole lot of people with courage, and in my particular case, I felt that I was being asked to do it by the boss, and the boss's his name is Yahweh, God of the Old Testament, was the reason that I went, and it really doesn't take much courage to say yes to an opportunity like that. If he wants you to go, there's pretty slim chance that you're going to get killed before you finish the mission. So I really didn't feel courageous in the least bit.
Well, that's an interesting slant on it in itself. Not too many people would have that much confidence to feel it, but that's a worthwhile way of looking at it. So how did you manage?
Yeah, ultimately, that's really the most important thing in the world. So, and what I found out is that the reason that I was sent was the fact that the terrorists are not killing us because they belong to Al-Qaeda. They're not killing us because they have corrupted some doctrine. They're not killing us because of Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein. They're killing us because 1,400 years ago, a man was demon-possessed, and he created a religion that is very satanic. And based upon that doctrine, they have grown to hate us, and they have been indoctrinated to think that killing us is doing a service to God. So what I found out is that we are engaged in spiritual warfare. That is the crux of Islamic terror.
So while many people and many journalists are saying that this is an aberration and it is not part of Islam, and most, well, it is perhaps true that many people who follow Islam do not subscribe to this, but you're saying that at somewhere at the core of Islam there is that tendency.
I'm telling you that every journalist who says that is not Islam hasn't a clue what Islam is. Literally doesn't have a clue, and that's not uncommon. My experience with the mainstream media, and the only exception is talk radio. I think it's kind of the last bastion of free and intelligent expression in America.
But, I do think that talk radio is holding a particular fort there, including people like Dr. Stan Monteith, who put out tremendous energy for these purposes.
I agree. But rather than just saying that there is a core of Islam that is violent and terroristic and hateful, the entire doctrine is violent, terroristic, and hateful. When you say that all Muslims are not terrorists, that is true. All terrorists happen to be Muslims, but all Muslims are not terrorists. And the only reason that all Muslims are not terrorists is that the majority of Muslims do not know their scriptures. They do not know that Muhammad was a terrorist. They do not know that to follow his example, which is what the Quran orders in the 33rd surah, that they would have to be a terrorist. They don't know that all of the Medina surahs, which were the last 24 revealed in the Quran, define a peaceful Muslim as the most vile of creatures, the worst of animals. So Allah's definition of a peaceful Muslim is extraordinarily negative. As a matter of fact, Allah says that a peaceful Muslim is such a rotten creature that the hottest places of hell are reserved for them. So if you are a peaceful Muslim and listening to my voice, you need to find a new God, because the one you have hates you.
Well, that's an extremely interesting viewpoint. How do people express this to you? The people that you met with, let's take your meeting with representatives of Al-Qaeda. First of all, can you maybe describe it? How did you get into it? Who led you there? What?
The way that I was able to broker the meeting with Al-Qaeda is because of my former business career. I'm reasonably well connected politically. I know the president on down. And so I was able, when I went to Israel, to arrange meetings with organizations like senior ministers within the Palestinian Authority and senior ministers within the Likud party and Knesset ministers and the like. So after 10 days of meeting with these people, I convinced them that I wasn't going to leave until they arranged a meeting with the terrorists. And what I found is that that Force 17, which is Yasser Arafat's personal bodyguard, that organization, it's kind of like our Secret Service, except these guys are terrorists, was kind of the glue that held these various organizations together, and they were the organization that brokered the meetings. All the Mossad did was take me to the border. They made me sign papers that said that what I was doing was crazy, that they would not have any idea where where this 417 members were going to take me, and that their experience had been that any journalist who had tried to do this was killed.
Goodness.
In fact, the last thing that the Mossad agent told me, and this is not a wimpy sort of a guy, this is a man who has probably as proud a record as any Mossad agent in Israel. He says, if you lift the handle of this door and walk across that border as you seem intent on doing, if you are not on God's mission, you are a dead man.
Very interesting.
So from there, I did lift the door handle, and I walked across what is called no man's land. We had a series of checkpoints and codes, almost in a James Bondish sort of way. In fact, it was a James Bondish thing. That people I would meet in certain cars and certain things we would say to one another to make contact, and then I was taken in a series of vans at gunpoint to a bunker deep inside what's called Zone A, Palestinian Authority territory. And there, over the next 6 hours, I met with terrorists, first from Fatah, the Oscar Martyrs Brigade, which is very much like the Ba'ath Party in Iraq. There.
And it is more or less Arafat's organization?
That is, yeah. Yasser Arafat did not found the PLO, as most people think. That was founded by Nasser, the communist leader of Egypt. But
General
Fatah,
Abdel Nasser?
Yes. Fatah was founded by Yasser Arafat. Fatah is a communist political party. It's the reason why the Palestinians constantly say that he is the popularly elected leader. Well, he's the only one that runs. You know, it's kind of like saying that you got a popularly elected leader in Red China. You know, you can vote yes and no, and the only people that get to vote are the people that agree with him.
this is a pretty convenient way to arrange an election. We should probably try.
Well, the last election, actually, he only got 96% of the vote, and the only person who did run against him was a 80 some odd year old woman social worker. Yes, but
and is she still around?
well, you know what, in that part of the world, the media will not cover it because if the mainstream media takes film of anything that is embarrassing to any of the Islamic organizations, they're not allowed back in. They're no longer given any access, and so you'll never see this on the evening news. But any so-called Palestinian that doesn't go along with the that radical party line is not only killed, they're very often mutilated. In fact, there's just recently a Palestinian became a Christian, and they took this man, cut him into four sections, and threw him back in his house in front of his young children in four pieces.
Goodness.
The kind of people we're dealing with here. Now, the first group that I met with were members of Fatah, a captain and two lieutenants, very polished individuals. They were particularly gleeful because they were still celebrating an event 2 days prior to my meeting with them.
What was the event?
They had blown the axle off a bus going to Emmanuel, and as the occupants of that bus, which were 11 women and children, left the bus, they blew off their heads at point-blank range with M16s.
Yeah.
And they were very, very pleased with themselves because they said they were not terrorists, they were army men, because rather than using a suicide bomber's belt, they used automatic rifles.
Well, that's, of course they should get medals for that, but goodness.
It's the kind of people that we as a nation are trying to give a country to. Now, these people are not extremists within their country. In fact, they are part of the normal structure, the normal strata politically of their country. This captain was a direct report directly to Yasser Arafat. He said that Yasser Arafat had ordered that particular mission. I asked him if he were to order you to kill tomorrow, would you? And he says, of course, I'm an army man. I follow orders. And by the way, the guns that Fatah, and this was the Oscar Martyrs Brigade, which is the armed unit of Fatah, the guns that they shot were paid for by the American taxpayer. They were part of the Oslo Accords, where Bill Clinton was encouraged by Yasser Arafat to give the PA both training and weapons so that they could form a PAPD and go after the bad guys. They used the training, which, by the way, two of the three men in that first group were trained by RCIA in Quantico. They used the training and they used the guns to kill Jews. Americans.
Why do you think that kind of accord was made and that kind of training offered and that kind of training given?
Because the American State Department has been indoctrinated with this concept from Shin Tzu that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that there is no such thing as moral high ground. You only form alliances for selfish strategic reasons. It became apparent that if we sided with the Palestinians, even though they were the same kind of terrorists that perpetrated 9/11, but if we if we formed an alliance with them, that the so-called moderate Arab states like Saudi Arabia would like us more and would be willing to sell us oil more cheaply. And so that is typically the reason that we do foolish things. We've also manufactured our own enemy at least 20 times in the last 100 years. For example, Saddam Hussein is somebody that would not be in power had America not propped him up with
He's
weapons. Supported
and backed him for many years, yes.
Yes, and the Mujahideen that became Al-Qaeda, not because of Osama bin Laden, but because of a Palestinian cleric, Al-Qaeda would not exist today had we not funded the Mujahideen because they were fighting the Russians. In fact, the Russians, who killed us, provided the weapons that killed 55,000 American men in Vietnam, did so because we propped up Stalin because he was fighting Hitler. Every place you turn, America has manufactured its next enemy. So we do incredibly stupid things. What we did in Afghanistan in this war on terror was stupid. What we did in Iraq was foolish. And what we're trying to do in Israel is equally foolish. And it's typically foolish for one of two reasons. Either the American State Department has no moral character at all and makes all decisions based on other than moral principles, or we are wholly ignorant. And in the case of terror, we are wholly ignorant.
Why do you think we maintain, I mean, first of all, we don't obviously know very much, but do you think that we maintain a kind of willful ignorance about some of this?
Well, I think our ignorance is willful, and that's the worst kind of ignorance of all. A great example would be in 1924, a man in prison wrote a book called Mein Kampf.
Yes.
In that book, which was basically a 1,000-page rant, in that book he said, I'm going to establish a new religion. The religion's God is Lucifer. I'm going to establish this religion, and he calls it a religion, because it is the best way for me to control my people and to encourage them to be martyrs so that I can get them to terrorize the world for the purpose of world conquest. That is what Mein Kampf says. It isn't the least bit coy. He wrote it in 1924. World War II did not start until 1939. We had 15 years to figure it out. We didn't. And because we didn't, we were woefully ignorant. 55 million people died. The same thing
was an article on that theme, calling it the man who meant what he said.
Yes.
And really not.
Now, what's most amazing, and this is what America does not know and the West does not know, because we are willfully ignorant again.
By the way, along the lines of Hitler and terrorism, during World War II, there were three different teams under Hitler competing to make a bomb that would drop itself on America, and in fact, a dirty bomb, a radioactive bomb. Among the three teams that were competing for a way to deliver it was the Wernher von Braun team, and two others, one with a winged aircraft, Wernher von Braun with a V-4 intended to reach New York and drop a dirty bomb on it.
And all they needed was one more year.
Yeah, and by the way, then they all strategically arranged not to surrender to people who would take them off to the Soviet Union or that kind of thing, and von Braun, of course, wound up the head of our space program.
Yes, he did. Now, what's interesting here, and this is the single most important thing I can communicate to your listeners, is that there is no difference between Mein Kampf and the Islamic scriptures. None. Apart from time and place, Muhammad and Hitler are the same. Apart from time and place, the Quran and Mein Kampf are exactly the same message, and the spirit behind them is identical.
Well, that's an extremely interesting statement. Hold that thought. We hear a little music in the background. I think we go to a couple of little breaks, and then we'll be right back. This is Myrna Culbreth at the Radio Liberty microphone, and we'll be back in moments.
pick it up.
Yes, okay. Well, this was a short break. Craig, if you would go on then. You've made a very provocative statement that the Quran is no different fundamentally, apart from time and place, from Mein Kampf.
Yes.
Give some specifics of that. What is it that you're saying that the Quran is saying?
The Quran says that we're going to use terrorism for the purpose of world conquest. The spirit known as Allah is identical to the spirit known as Fate in Mein Kampf. They are both Satan. The reward for dying in Mein Kampf is paradise. Valhalla is what Hitler calls it, and of course it is the virginal brothel in the case of Islam. The entire theme, even the word choices of the importance of the fighting, the hatred of pacifists, the renouncing of treaties. Mein Kampf says any treaty with an Aryan is not binding on the Aryan. The Quran says any treaty with a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. Virtually everything in both books is identical.
To what do you attribute that?
Same spirit wrote them. Adolf Hitler was demon-possessed. Muhammad was demon-possessed. Now, I know Muhammad was demon-possessed because he said he was demon-possessed.
He admitted he was demon-possessed.
The first revelation that he had in a cave late one night, the spirit beat him to the point of death. He tried to commit suicide. The first thing he did is run home, and he told his wife of 60 years that, "I fear for my life. Something very bad has happened to me. I have been possessed."
Very interesting. And then what did they do?
Well, his wife actually starts Islam by saying, "No, never. That is not what has happened to you. What has happened to you is that you are going to be the prophet of the moon god Allah." And the reason she said that is that she was a merchant. He worked for her. And 100% of the revenue in this little 5,000-person town of Mecca was attributed to a scam, a religious scam, that Muhammad's great-great-grandfather had started called Qusay. And so she says, "No, rather than demon-possessed hubby of mine, instead of that, you're going to be the custodian of what we'll call the Kaaba Inc." And she starts Islam and convinces him of what I call the profitable prophet plan. And from that point on, all of the Islamic scriptures are fixated on money. All of them.
So they, you say, fixated on money. They are collecting fees for this and fees for that.
Well, they start off with the fees for this and fees for that, but very quickly they go to 75 documented terrorist raids. Every one of the terrorist raids is an armed gang going after civilians and stealing their money. The Quran says stealing is lawful and good, and enslaving the women and children and selling the slaves, which is how Islam was funded. People have no idea how bad Islam really is.
So you're talking in the time of Muhammad, 75 terrorist raids? Well,
he himself led 75 terrorist raids. By the way, the Mein Kampf also.
Come back in a moment.
Go right ahead.
Yes, right. Okay, we're just going over the top of the music for a moment. And go ahead then, Craig. So you're talking in the time of Muhammad, his wife decided that he was not possessed by a demon but should become part of a new religion. Part of that new religion was to go out and make terrorist raids on neighboring communities and enslave and
right
their wealth?
Yes. Islam, during Muhammad's life, had two periods. There's the period in Mecca, which is the town that he was born, which is really a nothing little town, probably 5,000 people, all mud huts, not a roof in the entire town. There, he has no power. He does a lot of threatening. He accepts bribes. He accepts bribes of sex, power, and money. That's how the Meccans controlled him, was bribes of sex, power, and money. And for one of those bribes, he actually agrees with the Meccans and elevates their pagan goddesses and their god. Their pagan god was Allah. Muhammad's god at the time was a rock god from Yemen called Ar-Rahman. And Alat, Aluza, and Manat. And he goes to the Kaaba and says that all of these are really gods, and he rejects his god, which is Ar-Rahman, and then comes back a few months later and says, you know, it was Satan that revealed that Quranic verse. I spoke on behalf of Satan, and Allah's going to abrogate, which is, means cancel, that which Satan has offered. And then he says that that he's going to slaughter all of his kin in Mecca. When he leaves Mecca really in shame, Islam changes entirely. At that point, Muhammad becomes a terrorist. He enacts what's called the Pledge of Aqaba, whereby the townsfolk of what's called Yathrib, which becomes Medina, swear to wage war against all mankind on Muhammad's behalf. And in the first year, he leads 12 terrorist raids. Overall, in the 10 years that he is in Medina, he leads 75 terrorist raids. All but two are aggressive, where he goes out to neighboring towns to attack them. His guys are always armed. In 90-plus percent of the cases, the people they attack are unarmed, and they do it for the money. The Quran says that booty is lawful and good. They enslave the women and children, sell the women and children to other towns as slaves, and that's how Islam is formed. And this isn't my opinion. There's only one source of information on Muhammad. It's called the Islamic Sunnah, which is comprised entirely of hadiths. There's only four books that were written within 300 years of his life that contained this message, and that is what these books say. So Osama bin Laden is simply following the example Muhammad set.
Why do you think that for a good many years we did not hear as much as we do now about Allah and Muslim and the terrorist roots and or offshoots of that kind of thing? I mean, is it that they have become more numerous? Is it that the era of Israeli conflict has pumped this up to a breaking point? Is it that we funded enemies as in Afghanistan and Iraq? What's going on?
A combination of several things. The first is that prior to a gentleman named Qutb, who was an Egyptian academician, he was the number one academician head of all of public education in Egypt. He wrote a book called Signposts Along the Road. It's the Mein Kampf of the Islamic terrorist movement. And in it, he says that he reshaped the mainstream Islamic thinking back to what the Quran said, which is that good Muslims, which are jihadists, by Allah's definition, shouldn't just be killing bad Muslims, peaceful Muslims by the Quran's definition. They should also reach out and kill disbelievers, particularly Christians and Jews. So he formed the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood became the model for all of the terrorist organizations that we see today. They're all, in one way or another, a derivative of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And he lived in Egypt, and let's pin him down as to time period in a minute. So his foundation was the Muslim Brotherhood, you're saying?
Yes, late 1950s, early 1960s. Now, at that time, Israel is still feeling the brunt of this, but America is not close enough to Israel to pay much attention.
So we just kind of let Israel fend for itself while five Arab nations attacked it after it was formed.
They were flying French Mirage jets because we wouldn't supply them.
All right, we'll come back in a moment. Hi, Chris.
Quick, right ahead.
Craig, let's pick it up from there. So the essential shift was, instead of just killing peaceful Muslims, they now decided to target everybody, particularly Jews and Christians?
Yeah, and that's one of it really drives us to one of the most irresponsible statements that you hear in today's media, that the problem with Islam is the Wahhabist, and if it wasn't for the Wahhabist, everything would be just fine. The Wahhabs, which was a group of Saudis in the 1400s through about the 1700s, were like all of the other Islamic organizations. They focused on killing peaceful Muslims. And so in the late 50s, early 60s, Islamic organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, and then it became Al-Jihad, and then Islamic Jihad, and Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Jamaat-Islamiyah, all of these organizations followed the model of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in addition to focusing on killing Jews, because Muhammad said, kill any Jew who falls under your control, kill every Jew in the country. Muhammad hated Jews. It's one of the commonalities between Mein Kampf and the Quran. Both of them are extraordinarily racist towards the Jews. Both of them call Jews apes and swine. The Quran itself calls Jews apes and swine. And Hitler was equally condemning of the church, as was Muhammad. In fact, the Quran says, wipe the infidels out to the last, and it defines infidel as anyone who says that Christ is the Messiah. So that would be Christians. But as you move through the 60s and the 70s, what we see is airplanes being hijacked and cruise liners being hijacked and
a man in a wheelchair being pushed overboard.
Yes, and we see barracks in Beirut being blown up, and we see barracks in Saudi Arabia being blown up, and we see hotels being blown up and nightclubs being blown up. And well, the fact of the matter is that a little over 90% of the violence and terror worldwide is caused by 20% of the people. And if only 20% of Muslims are jihadists, that means that a good Muslim is 2,000% more violent than the rest of us.
Well, that's a pretty interesting mathematical progression.
It's so obvious that fundamental Islam is at the root cause of terror. When we found the prayer request of the 9/11 terrorists, it didn't say, Hail Osama. In fact, Osama bin Laden really had very little to do with 9/11. It was conceived in the Al-Qaeda Mosque in Hamburg, Germany. But they said, in those prayer requests, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar means Allah is greatest. And so every time that we confront Islamic terror, they're yelling what's called the prayer of fear, Allahu Akbar. They're doing this because their Quran says that if they're a good Muslim and leave their homes to fight jihad for Allah's cause, they will go to Allah's brothel. And that's what the Quran says. The Quran says that martyrs go to a place where there are multiple virgins and rivers flowing with wine. And that's why they kill Christians and Jews.
So they're not supposed to drink on earth, but at the end of the game, they get rivers of wine?
You know, what's so amazing about the Quran and the Hadith is that everything is as foolish as what you've just said. On earth, you can be stoned for fornication, and yet what is a place where you have multiple, many of the imams say as many as 70, but the Quran says 2, but where you have virgins who are taking care of your sexual fantasies and rivers that flow with wine, and yet wine and fornication are both outlawed on earth. Everything in Islam is that way. Everything is nothing but a lie and a contradiction. What I want more than anything is that Muslims who live in a country like America, where they're free to think and where rejecting Islam is not a death sentence, in every Islamic nation, if you reject Islam, the Quran says and Islamic law says you must be killed. But in America, we don't allow that. So I want every Muslim to read their scriptures. I want them to read those four books of hadith collections, because there is no way any rational person can be exposed to Islam and not reject it.
To what extent do you think people who believe in Islam do read those scriptures or do have some access to them or take a look at them?
Yeah, I think that what happens is that in Islam, Muslims believe that they have been indoctrinated to believe that only a licensed imam can tell them what the Quran and the Hadith says. And so they trust their soul to these imams who are lying to them. It is really a sad situation. Occasionally on the radio, I will have a Muslim, usually women, not men, who will call and say, you know, what you're saying about Muhammad is disgusting and revolting. And I say, I'm glad you think it's disgusting and revolting, because that means you still have a conscience. That means you don't think pedophilia is a good idea. Muhammad was a pedophile. You don't think rape's a good idea. Muhammad was a rapist. You don't think incest was a good idea. Muhammad was involved in incest. You don't think the terrorism is a good idea.
Why don't you spell those out a little bit, Craig?
Yeah, and what I did, just to finish that thought, what they will do in many of these shows, they'll call the host of that show back 2 days later and said, you know, I took his dare. I read the hadith, and he's right. It's exactly what they say. And I have rejected Islam.
Now, that's very interesting.
Let me tell you about Muhammad. When he went to Medina, the first thing that he did is he married a six-year-old girl. He was 50 years old at the time. We have a word for a man who is 50 years old who marries a six-year-old. Pedophilia is the word. There's no other description of it. That's what the Islamic scriptures say, is when he was 50, she was six.
Why, allegedly, why did he do that?
Because she was real cute. That's what the hadith says.
Because she was cute?
She was really cute. She was the cutest girl in town. Cute. They pulled her, according to the hadith, she was with her babysitter, her nurse, if you will, and she was pulled off a swing. Her face was wiped. She was hurried to her parents' bedroom, where Muhammad was sitting on her parents' bed, and her mother then took her by the hand and placed her in Muhammad's lap and left the room.
Good heavens.
So that's how we start. That's the first recorded event in what's called the Islamic era, when Muhammad leaves Mecca in shame after the satanic verses. Following that, we have incest. Most attractive woman, let's call this Aisha, this little child, let's call her a girl. At 6 to 9 years old, she's hardly a woman. The most attractive woman is Zainab, but unfortunately she's married. But she's not just married, she's married to Muhammad's son.
Goodness.
So he sends him off on a terrorist raid. They call them, by the way, raids, and he went after, in this case, a caravan, which was a civilian enterprise, so it was a terrorist raid. And while he was off on this terrorist raid, he went into the tent of Zainab, saw her undressed, said that he lusted for her, and he married his daughter-in-law. That's incest. The Quran, by the way, has a surah, the 33rd surah, that is dedicated to Allah telling Muhammad that anything that he wants is his, that any woman belongs to him. Every woman belongs to him. He is not to deny himself anything. Now, let's go to rape. The first example of rape in the Islamic hadith, this is a very disgusting man, Muhammad. The first example, and there are many, of Muhammad himself participating in rape, but the first one is that Muhammad has banished two of the three Jewish settlements in Yathrib, which he renamed Medina. And by banishing the Jews, he took towns that were probably settlements of 10 to 15,000 people. And he surrounded them, starved them with his armed raiders, and sent the Jews off into the desert to die. Women, children, and all, and he stole their homes. And the Quran confirms this, the Hadith confirms this. The third time he did it was with the Banu Qurayza. And with the Qurayza, he was not as genteel. He had trenches dug in the marketplace of what is today Medina. He took every boy over the age of 12, tied their hands behind their back, tied a rope around their neck, and in small groups over the course of about 10 hours, he brought them out while he sat there and watched, with their women tied with him and forcing them to watch. He cut off every boy's head and threw their heads and their bodies in this trench. He then sold all of the children, all of the Jewish children, thousands of them, into slavery. And then he divvied up the women amongst his militants, with himself getting first dibs. He picked the prettiest one, and they raped them. This is the lone prophet of Islam. It is why, without question, he's the most evil man who ever lived. And what makes him particularly evil is not the fact that he was just a pedophile, not just the fact he was involved in incest, not just the fact he was involved in multiple rapes, not the fact that he was probably the most prolific terrorist of all time, leading 75 terrorist raids. It's the fact that he did this claiming that he was the messenger of God and he established a religion whose legacy has damned 3 billion people. That makes him the most evil man who ever lived.
Well, that's an extremely interesting kind of story. I note the contrast with some other founders of religions who were, by and large, either benevolent or at least innocuous.
You know, there's only, in modern history, there's really only two founders of religion. Yeah, I mean, some would say that Mormonism is a unique religion, and some might say that Scientology is a unique religion. But realistically, if you really look at major religious movements, Mein Kampf, Nazism was a religion. Adolf Hitler founded it, and Islam was a religion, and Muhammad founded it. Both satanic. Christianity is not a religion. Christ hated religion. He was anti-religious. And Judaism isn't religious. In fact, the word religion doesn't even appear in the entire Old Testament. Judaism is a covenant. It's a relationship with Yahweh. And Christianity is a relationship with Yeshua, which means Yahweh saves, Yahweh incarnate in the form of a man. So neither of those things are the least bit religious. In fact, as I say, the Bible is anti-religious rather than being a religious organization. Buddha didn't found a religion. He was not religious in the least. His doctrine was 100% a societal form of enlightenment. People after him turned Buddhism into a religion. So we're really dealing with Adolf Hitler and Muhammad in terms of founders of religion. And the difference between one and the other is that Hitler was just more honest about it. He says, I'm forming this religion, and this is what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to use it to annihilate Jews, to terrorize the world, and for world conquest, and to cause men to be willing to be martyrs for me. Now, that's the story of the Quran, but the Quran is a little less honest.
Getting back to your trip to meet with the terrorists, let's pick up that story a little bit. You went in, you started to meet with them. They were proud of themselves for having shot up people as they climbed off a bus they had disabled. What did they say to you about why they hated America, or what did they say to you about September 11th, for example?
Well, the first group of terrorists didn't hate America. They loved America. They said, you supply us almost all of our money. You supply us our weapons. You are our principal lever against the Jews. We love Americans. That's Fatah. Now, the second group of terrorists, which was Islamic Jihad, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Al-Qaeda, exactly the opposite. They hated America, and therefore me, with a passion. But the difference is the first group of terrorists were principally political terrorists, very much like the Ba'ath Party and Republican Guards and all of that stuff in Iraq.
Where, they're basically secular, more or less, even though...
Yeah, they are Muslims. However, they're principally secular. The Ba'ath Party in Iraq is a fascist organization. It's modeled after Adolf Hitler's Nazism.
Yes.
And as which we found when we went into Iraq, is that our troops were not killed by the Ba'ath Party. In fact, the Ba'ath Party faded into oblivion. It was the Jihad All-Star team that has laid in wait and killed the hundreds of Americans in Iraq. We have been killed exclusively by fundamentalist Muslim jihadists.
So these are basically, you're saying, in Iraq, more or less outside people, or at least...
Combination of, I mean, they don't have to look too far outside to find jihadists in a country that's 98% Islamic. But reinforcing the homegrown jihadists in Iraq, you have tens of thousands that have come in from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Syria, Jordan, the so-called Palestinian areas, Egypt, Indonesia. So they've really put together a jihad all-star team to take pot shots at American soldiers, which is why what we're doing there is really insane. But the second group of terrorists, when I asked them why they were killing us, they quoted out of the Islamic Hadith, they quoted the speeches of their prophet Muhammad, and they quoted out of the Quran the words of their God Allah. And they said that that the Quran ordered them to continue to fight us until there were no more of us. That's pretty straightforward. So I was therefore in a position that really everyone in politics, everyone in the media in America should have been in, which is that what they're telling me is not a lot different than a Osama bin Laden press release. If you read those, he gives Allah credit for everything and talks about the importance of the Quran, talks about jihad warriors, talks about the orders that Allah has to wipe out the infidels. And so his answers are the same as what these folks said. And so the fundamental question is, were they quoting their scriptures correctly? If they were, then they were not corrupting their religion. Or were they quoting them incorrectly? Were they taking them out of context and misquoting them? And if that was the case, then they are not good Muslims, and they have, in fact, corrupted their religion. That's the million-dollar question right there. What I found was that they were quoting their scriptures exactly the way they were written, and rather than taking them out of context, the Quran and the Hadith are overwhelmingly violent and hateful. And that's the thing that troubles me the most about the mainstream press and our politicians, is that we are lying to ourselves, to the world, when we say that the terrorists have corrupted a otherwise peaceful religion. When they quote the Quranic and Hadith orders to wipe infidels, Christians and Jews, out to the last, they're not corrupting their religion. That's exactly what their religion orders them to do.
Why do you think that the press and or many people up to perhaps including the president are saying, well, we're not at war with Islam, we're at war with extremists, etc.?
Well, for the media and for the president, it's different reasons. For the media, most of the mainstream media follows what I call the false religion of political correctness. Political correctness is a belief system very much like communism or fascism or any other belief system, or like Islam. And in that world, if you step an inch outside of their circle, you are publicly humiliated, disgraced, and you don't work again. And so there is no likelihood that anyone in the mainstream media is going to ever deal with Islam, because to be intolerant of a religion, particularly one that hates Christians, is way outside of what they consider to be part of their doctrine of political correctness. So you'll never see one doing it. Also, they're all threatened. Every major mainstream media outlet has been threatened by Islam with boycotts and protestations if they were to have anyone on who would expose the doctrine as I do. Now, with the President of the United States, I believe that the President of the United States is purposefully misleading the American people because it is politically expedient for him to do so. I believe we are in Iraq because it was politically expedient to be in Iraq, even though there is no moral justification for us being there. There's no practical justification. There is no moral justification. It was more foolish than us going into Vietnam.
What do you think will happen in Iraq?
Same thing that is happening every day. And this is not armchair quarterbacking here. When I wrote Tea with Terrorists, I wrote it fully a year before we went into Iraq. I knew we would do so, and I have not only in the book, but also in a year's worth of radio appearances, I have been begging my country not to do this, and now that we're there, to get out of there. And the reason that it is such a foolish undertaking is manyfold. One is, we say that we're at war with terror, and particularly because of 9/11. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. And as it relates to being a sponsor of terror, he's a bit player. The big player, the biggest player by far, is Saudi Arabia. And second to Saudi Arabia is Iran. Third to those two is Egypt. And so we went barking up the wrong tree as it relates to terror. That's not smart. Second, if he had weapons of mass destruction and was willing to use them on the United States, then he would have been a clear and present danger. But the fact he didn't use them on our troops, even when we were in his backyard, means he was never going to use them on our soil. In fact, Tenet with the CIA begged the president not to go in for the same reason. He says there is zero likelihood that this man's going to use weapons of mass destruction on America, which means he was not a clear and present danger. And here we're in Iraq and we can't even find any of these things. And ultimately, it was a lose-lose game. If he had them and used them on our troops, then the price for his head would have been way too high. We'd have lost tens of thousands of young men. And if he didn't use them on our troops when we were in his backyard, then there was no chance he was going to use them on America. Therefore, the reason for going in was a lie. That's not a good scenario. Now, there's something far worse than all of that. Because we haven't read the Mein Kampf of Islam, we have no idea why they hate us. Therefore, when Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld felt that once we liberated this country that they'd be throwing roses at us and they would be so ecstatic that we had done this great service for them and we would be able to leave as fast as we had come, they've got no idea what motivates these people. And instead of finding that, we find 400,000-person marches protesting against America, and rather than handing us flowers, they hand us bullets. There has never been an Islamic democracy. Islam is about submission. There is no choice in Islam. It's the most reoccurring theme in the last 24 surahs is submit and obey. Therefore, you can never have an Islamic country and a democracy. And so our stated goal of liberating this country and not leaving until they have established a democracy will never occur. It's impossible. So from every perspective you can possibly look at, we did the wrong thing. even if we wanted to be international do-gooders, because Saddam Hussein was a terrible man, and he tortured a lot of his people. If we're going to be international do-gooders, which, by the way, I'm in favor of doing, you've got to pick the places where you can do the most good. If you wanted to do that today, you would not go to Iraq, where tens of thousands have been killed. You'd go to the Sudan, where 2 million have been killed in the last 13 years. You would have gone to Cambodia during Pol Pot's regime, where he killed 2 million. You would have entered World War II within a year of Hitler coming to power, when he opened Dachau and started killing Jews.
Yes.
And but we didn't do those
to this country.
Yeah. So there is a case that I believe that any time you see a despot, whether it's Islamic, which is the principal despots today, or communist, with Stalin and what he did, or Hitler and what he did, or Pol Pot and what he did, or what's happening in the Sudan as we speak, when you see millions being killed, then the international community has an obligation to go in and help those defenseless people.
I would agree with that.
But when it's tens of thousands, even though that would be a wonderful thing to do, that means that we would have to be in you know, a third of the countries on the planet. You just can't do that. And so we picked the wrong country to liberate from genocide, because there is no genocide in Iraq, but there is genocide of terrible consequence in both Rwanda and particularly in the Sudan.
You think something could be done helpfully in Rwanda or Sudan?
No, because America has lost sight of its maker. We've lost the moral high ground, and our State Department has no interest in doing the right thing because of the human suffering that is taking place there. We went into Iraq principally because it was politically expedient to do so. And there are no political kudos for going into Sudan. We don't do things because it's the right thing to do anymore.
Again, getting back to your meeting with the terrorists, which I think is fascinating, the second group, when you sat down with them, or describe when they started to come in and you started to talk to them, what happened?
Well, rather than being very polished, articulate individuals in very handsome-looking uniforms, this second group was right out of Central Casting. We're talking about beards and crooked teeth and snarls and eyes that could burn holes right through your soul. And while the first group were armed, the guns weren't pointed at me. The second group, not only were the guns pointed at me, but during my entire meeting with them, they threatened to kill me.
All right, we're getting a little break from the music, and we'll come right back and pick it up with the guns pointed at you. This is Myrna Kovas at Radio Liberty. We're having actually a changeover to the top of the next hour program, and we'll be right back with the same guests, however, Craig Bloom, expert on terrorism, she was terrorist, Prophet of Doom. And this is Radio Liberty. Dr. Sand, should I start the top of the next hour? We're here with Craig Wynn. His books are Key with Terrorists, which is a very interesting title, by the way. And yes, hello from the Radio Liberty microphone. This is Myrna Culbreth, the author of The Phonics Game and Phonicsopoly, sitting in for Dr. Stan Monteith while he recovers his voice a bit. And we have spent an hour, which some of you may have been with us and perhaps some not. We've been interviewing Craig Wynn, who has an extensive business background, but he set out after September 11th to find out, why do these people want to kill us? And he actually went and met with terrorists after some arrangements through Israel and the Mossad and other groups through his business connections there, and he went and had a six-hour meeting with terrorists. He was describing a little bit the first group linked to Al-Fatah, and then the second group with links to Al-Qaeda and various other organizations. Craig, I'll let you pick it up there. Why don't you recap a little bit for the benefit of people who might be joining us then go on with how they've got guns pointed at you.
Sure, yeah. The first group being principally political, the second group's 100% religious. They don't take orders from Yasser Arafat. They don't have any political affiliation whatsoever. They are strictly good Muslims. They quote on almost every answer from the Islamic Hadith, the speeches or example of Muhammad, or from the Quran. They actually carry prayer beads, kind of like the Roman Catholic rosary beads, and are constantly trying to chant Islamic prayers as they stroke their guns. What I found is that those who are indoctrinated with Islam lose their ability to think. These men were no longer rational. The conversation I had with the first group, while they were revolting in what they had done, they were capable of conducting an intelligent conversation, and you could at least speak rationally to them. The second group were irrational. And to talk to people who have literally no understanding of history, they have no understanding of the world's circumstance, of anything beyond what they have been indoctrinated with, is a very frustrating experience. And every time I would ask them a question, and they would say something that was just stupid, I mean, dumb, I would challenge them. And by challenging them, they got angrier and angrier with me, to the point they said that we think you're CIA, and started brandishing their weapons at me, and that's why the book is called Tea with Terrorists. The 417 member wasn't going to get what he wanted from the Mossad unless somehow I could get out of this meeting alive, and it didn't look like that was going to happen. And so he brought down tea in this dainty little porcelain tea set, thinking that it would be harder for them to pull the triggers of their automatic weapons if that same finger was holding a delicate little porcelain teacup full of
beverage. Well, that's pretty good. And who brought this in, the group?
The 417 member who was the host of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is part of Yasser Arafat's personal bodyguards is what the 417 is.
I see, right.
So they brought down the tea sets, and of course the first question is they bring down the sugar cubes, and you know, you want one lump or two. And you know, when you're surrounded by terrorists, that's not a very appealing option. You know, I think I'll pass and not have any lumps.
Right.
But that's how the book became Tea with Terrorists, is that to stay alive, we literally had tea with them as they told us why they would go about killing us. Now, the second group of terrorists that I met with, there isn't a single one of them that's alive today.
Really?
Over the next 6 months, they either killed themselves being suicide bombers, or they were killed. One doesn't live a very long time once one has decided to be a jihadist. That is not something that one does until one is old. What I keep on wondering, though, is if strapping a suicide bomb to one's body is such a good idea, why doesn't the young man, or now it's an equal opportunity killing the young woman, ask his or her imam, if this is such a good idea, why aren't you doing it?
Right. That would be a pretty pregnant question.
Yes, but of course you've never seen an imam strap a suicide bomb to their bodies, have you? Never.
Not that I know of.
Nope. But they certainly like to instill that in others. You know, one of the things that I brought up in Tea with Terrace is that the foremost authority on the Quran in the world is a gentleman named Sheikh Rahman. He was the senior professor of Quranic studies at Al-Jahar University, which is the preeminent Islamic university in the world in Cairo, Egypt. Now, this foremost authority on the Quran is currently a guest of the United States government and a United States penitentiary in New York. He's there because he was the mastermind behind the first bombing of the World Trade Center.
Interesting.
So if Islam is a peaceful religion, why is the Quran's number one scholar worldwide a terrorist?
Well, that's a fairly pregnant question. Does anybody other than typically you point out that he's the leading Quran scholar?
No. And it's not hard to find out. The same man was responsible for the assassination of Anwar Sadat. The reason he's in the United States is that he presented his own case to the Supreme Court of Egypt. And he was exonerated, not of the plot. He admitted that he wanted him killed, Anwar Sadat killed, but he presented the fact that the Quran orders Muslims to kill peaceful Muslims, and so he was exonerated by the all-Islamic Supreme Court of Egypt, and because the United States is willfully ignorant, I think we talked about that earlier in this discussion, we accepted him in the United States. Now, the highest-ranking cleric in the Islamic world, particularly from the Sunnis, which represent the majority of Muslims worldwide, is the senior imam in Saudi Arabia. I actually work directly for the Fahd family. This is what he has in every Quran, 80% of the Qurans in the United States, 80% of the mosques in the United States, 80% of the imams in the United States are funded by the Saudi royal family. This is their definition of jihad in the Quran. Jihad is holy fighting in Allah's cause with full force of weaponry. It is given the utmost importance in Islam and is one of its pillars upon which it stands. By jihad, holy fighting in Allah's cause, Islam is established and Allah's religion is propagated. By abandoning jihad, may Allah protect us from that. Islam is destroyed, and Muslims fall into an inferior position. Their honor is lost, their lands are stolen, their rule and authority vanish. Jihad is an obligatory duty in Islam on every Muslim, and he who escapes from this duty dies a hypocrite. I would say that's reasonably clear.
That's very clear.
Now, if you want the Quran's definition of what one must do if you are a good Muslim, I'll read from the 8th surah. Allah has sent you from your homes to fight for the true cause. Allah wished to confirm the truth by his words. Wipe the disbelieving infidels out to the last. I shall terrorize them. So smite them on their necks in every joint and incapacitate them, for they are opposed to Allah and his apostle. Whoever opposes Allah and his apostle should know that Allah is severe in retribution. So fight them until all opposition ends. How long should they fight them? Until all opposition ends, and the only religion is Islam. If you meet them in battle, inflict such a defeat upon them that it would serve as a lesson for those who would come after them, that they may be warned. if you apprehend treachery from a people with whom you have a treaty. Retaliate by breaking it off. The infidel should not think they could bypass Allah. Surely they cannot get away. Prepare against them whatever arms and cavalry you can muster, that you may terrorize the enemies of Allah. Now, the sheikh that is the highest-ranking Islamic cleric in the world said this on a national telethon, a telethon that raised, by the way, $109 million to reward the Palestinian suicide bombers. He said, "I am against America." This man's name is Barak. "I am against America. She is the root of all evils and wickedness on earth. O Muslims, do not take Jews and Christians as allies. Muslim brothers, do not have any mercy or compassion on them, their blood, their money, their flesh. Their women are yours to take legitimately. Allah made them yours. Why don't you enslave their women? Why don't you wage jihad? Why don't you pillage them?"
He's a very friendly spirit.
He is the highest ranking Islamic cleric in the world.
And his name is, again?
Barak. He is
B-A-R. How do you
18, 18 different spellings of every Arabic word English, but the American media spells his name B-U-R-A-I-K.
B-U-R-A-I-K. Well, he seems a very friendly soul, so he would just...
Everything that he read is right out of the Quran. Everything he said is right out of the Quran. He didn't make any of that up. It's not his opinion.
But of course, Craig, he could not be saying these things without the permission of the Saudi family, because they fund him and all of the imams over there in Saudi Arabia.
But not only do they fund him and all of the imams in Saudi Arabia, they fund 80% of the mosques in the Western world, including 80% of the mosques in America. They staff those mosques with their imams, and they put in the Qurans that I just read the definition of jihad out of. The fact of the matter is that the Saudi Arabian royal family is the principal manufacturing facility for terrorists worldwide. They are our principal enemy.
And, of course, they're working on our prisons, converting the blacks to the Muslim faith.
Yes,
and of course, but the most frightening thing is they're being protected by the Bush administration that left some 28 pages out, or deleted 28 pages from the special report put out by the Joint Intelligence Committee pointing to the Saudi financing of terrorism, and specifically what happened on September
11th. All that is true, and it's worse than that. Let me give you two other things that are even worse than that. On September 11th, there was only one airplane, civilian airplane, flying anywhere over United States airspace. It was owned by the Fahd family. It was a 747. It went to most of the major cities in America, and it picked up members of the bin Laden family. And it flew them back to Saudi Arabia.
So without permission, it was flying?
The Bush administration's permission. It was the only civilian airplane given the permission to fly on that day. And it picked up bin Laden family members and flew them back to Saudi Arabia with the Bush administration's permission.
Well, that's a pretty interesting story, and I don't think I've heard anything resembling that.
It's just in the last 3 days. It's been on the front page of a lot of the international news, like International Tribune and those kinds of international newspapers. The flight controllers in cities like Boston and Los Angeles have all said yes. The Saudi Arabian flight was here, and yes, we were told to let it fly, and that the orders came directly from the administration.
That's quite a story. Well, as Dr. Sam said, there were pages deleted pointing to the Saudi Arabian role. What happened with that?
Well, that was actually the second such situation. The Pentagon funded a study as to what the root cause of 9/11 was. They asked the RAND Corporation to do it. The RAND Corporation came back and said, it's the Saudis. And so the report became classified, and the person who made the report was fired and disgraced. And so when we had the congressional hearings and that report that was supposed to be the full disclosure of what happened on 9/11, they come out and said it was the Saudis. And so we classify the 28 pages that's the core of who funded it.
So we could have a little slogan, it was the Saudis stupid, or?
It was the Saudis stupid. Now, I want to tell you that the Saudis do not act alone. When I was meeting with the terrorists, I found out that they were, in fact, mercenaries, and that the family of a suicide bomber gets $1 million from the Saudi royal family. But they do not act alone. The Iranians are almost as bad. In some ways, the Iranians are worse. The Syrians are almost as bad. They just don't have as much money. The Kuwaitis are almost as bad as the others. They have one thing in common, and it's not Al-Qaeda. The thing that they all have in common is fundamental Islam. And that is why they do what they do. But when we as a nation, and this is one of the ultimate answer to the question that you asked me earlier, why all of a sudden are we dealing with so much more of this in America? The last ingredient is money. The largest wealth transfer in the history of the world is undergoing as we speak. We are transferring $1 billion a day to pay for black ooze that comes from the sands, that is taken out of those sands by refineries that were built by American citizens. American citizens owned those companies that owned all of the refineries in the Middle East. They were confiscated by the warlords that run these countries, and today we transfer $1 billion a day to them. And with that money, they're manufacturing terrorists.
Is there a solution for that kind of wealth transfer?
Yes. Now, there was a solution that we could have deployed intelligently in the 1960s when these facilities were stolen around the world, which is to protect American interests, because these were all large corporations that were owned by average citizens, and we should have taken them back. We didn't do that. Then when we didn't take them back, we should have immediately become oil independent by drilling offshore in Alaska. Had we done that, we would not be paying for our own funeral today. But we did not do those two things, which means we no longer have time. Saudi Arabia already has nuclear weapons because they helped fund the Pakistani development, and Iran will have nuclear weapons within 6 months. So we are now out of time. As a result, I think that the only thing that we can do as a nation is, rather than trying to occupy Iraq, which is a lose-lose game, is instead simply to control the flow of oil out of those nations so that we make certain that zero oil dollars go to manufactured terrorists.
However, if you did that, how would you start to implement a policy like that, and would it immediately lead to a large conflagration?
Well, first of all, we as a nation have shown that we have the ability to render a country like Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, any of these countries, we can render their ability to wage war moot within a matter of hours. Now, rendering their ability to wage war is very different than occupying their countries. Occupying a country and sending a serviceman down the street with a gun while other people take pot shots at him is stupid. But we very easily could destroy the war-making ability of these four or five largest oil-producing nations that are manufacturing terrorists, and surround the the distribution facilities and the refineries and protect those, and that would be 100 times easier than what we are currently trying to do in Iraq. Now, in terms of escalating, in terms of escalating war, by transferring $1 billion a day and not correctly identifying that it is fundamental Islam that is trying to kill us, we are in fact playing right into the hands of escalation. We're playing into the hands of the final biblical prophecy, which says that within 2 years of the time that a peace treaty is signed between Israel and many nations, guaranteeing Israel's security, that Islamic countries, all Islamic countries in the war of Gog and Magog, will attack Israel. The Bible says that because of the fact that countries like the United States have separated itself from God, and because of the world having done the same thing, that the consequence of that war is that 5 out of every 6 Muslim attackers are going to die. It's 1 billion people. And 5 altogether, 1/4 of the Earth's population dies in World War III, which would mean it'd be 500 million non-Muslims in addition to 1 billion Muslims. So that is the course we are currently on. And it will start exactly as World War II started. We're going to give the high ground of Israel to the doctrine that is killing us, just as we gave Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler.
So you see another Munich, namely the ceding of Israel or parts of it?
Yep. Well, you know, thus far the Bible's had 2,000 prophecies and everyone's been precisely accurate. It's got another 500 to go in the end times, and I wouldn't bet against Yahweh. He's been 2,000 for 2,000. My guess is you'll get the next 500. But we are playing right into that, and unfortunately, because we are unwilling to identify Islam as the sole source of this terrorist rage against us, and we're unwilling to stop the flow of money, and Islam from its birth has been nothing but a crusade to steal other people's money. It runs on money, and today that money is oil money, and it is the reason why terrorism in the West is such a problem now, is because of the enormous amounts of money that Islamic clerics have to bribe suicide bombers.
Well, that's pretty interesting. What do you think, when you met with some of the people from the Mossad and other Israeli institutions or the Likud party, what are they saying now about what's going on, or what were they saying then?
The Mossad says that, same thing that I wrote in Tea with Terrorists, that we have a 99% likelihood in America that one of our major cities, in all likelihood, New York and Washington again, will be victimized by a radiological dispersion device, a biological weapon, or a nuclear bomb within the next 10 years. And that this time 1 million people will die. It is their opinion, and it is my opinion, that we have a 99% likelihood that that will occur. And in Tea with Terrorists, I go to great pains to explain how a radiological dispersion device actually works, what the materials are that are in them, where they would come about getting these materials, how they would use them, and what the effect of them would be in one of our cities.
And by the way, we should say, I think, that Tea with Terrorism has a lead-in, in effect, in which you describe some of this incident, and then it is, in effect, a novel.
In fact, Tea with Terrorists is written in the form of a novel because I wanted to put it, I wanted at the time to write it 3 years in advance. Now it's a year and a half in advance, because I wanted America to understand the consequence of its present course. And so the best way to do that was in the form of a novel. And in addition to that, it was much easier to write, for example, my meeting with the terrorists, what that experience was like, my questions, their answers, in the form of a novel, Although I've written my questions exactly as I asked them and described the setting and the and their answers exactly as they gave them, in addition to my meeting with all of the other politicos and generals and Secret Service folks, as well as my discovery, the voyage of discovery through the Islamic scriptures, it was just a much more effective way of being able to communicate this truth. But it also enabled me to show to America what the consequence is of our current ignorance. And so I do have the terrorists deploying the kinds of weapons I believe that they will deploy on the United States and share with America how they will do it, where they will do it, how they will work, and how many people will die. Because there is a consequence to doing the wrong thing, and that's what we're doing now. It's what we did in Afghanistan. That's what we're doing in Iraq. That's what we're doing every day in our media. That's what we're doing in the Oval Office. There is a consequence for doing the wrong thing, and in Tiwa Terrace, I share that consequence, and it's hellish.
It's pretty scary. Does the Mossad or other people that you met with in Israel do they project a solution, a hope, a belief there that something could happen, or what?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Mossad in both agents in the United States and Mossad agents in Israel, I believe that Tiwa Terrace is the most accurate account ever written of the not only what the current threat from mainstream Islam is, but how America will suffer in the future, as well as what is the only practical solution. In fact, the Mossad agent that is in the book is modeled after a real person. In fact, almost everything in the book is actually a non-fiction. Very little of it is actually fictional. Including the Mossad agent.
More in fiction, as Gene Roddenberry was fond of pointing out.
Yes, The Right Stuff, which Wolf wrote about our moon program.
Yes,
that was a novel, but yet it depicted real events. The Perfect Storm novel depicted real events. The best book ever written on Gettysburg is Killer Angels, and that's also written in the form of a novel, but yet it's become a perhaps the most effective communicating tool today to use dialogue to be able to communicate. It's very much like Christ teaching with parables. If you tell a story, you can be more effective in communicating than if you just try to the term, I guess the other term would be to lecture, and most people don't want to be lectured, but we do all want to be entertained.
Well, that likely is true. There are not a lot of people who read serious nonfiction books on that subject. There are more that do read novels, thrillers, political
yes.
thrillers. What is the form of the, let me understand, you're coming out with, or you have
oh, yes,
come out
Prophet
with
of
the
Doom.
New book?
Yes, Prophet of Doom is completed. It's now with the typographical editors. It'll go off to the printer. Prophet of Doom is a nonfiction book. Many of the readers of Tiwa Terrace said that actually acquiring English translations of the five Islamic holy books was extremely difficult for them to do, and it's true, it is. In fact, the more I expose them, the more Muslims work to try to make it impossible for English-speaking people to get them. So I took those books and I put them together, and then I gave all of it, including the Quran chronology, and Prophet of Doom takes the five holy books of Islam and does a running commentary on those five books. So it's a very serious study on Islam, maybe the most serious study that's ever been written on Islam.
Extremely interesting. When do you expect that to be out? Well, we're hearing a little music.
Six to 8 weeks.
Wow, coming along. I assume that Radio Liberty will have it at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Yes, Craig, let me ask you, the Prophet of Doom book, is that being, is that by a publisher? Is it self-published? How does that work?
Craig Song Book is the, has been the publishing company for each of the, the books that I have written. And, well, there are others now that are asking to publish these. I think I'm still going to put it out under under Cricket Song Books, because what I write is so controversial. My preference is to be able to manage the entire process. The interesting thing about Prophet of Doom is that I've chosen to have it written so that there are two different fonts, and half the book is in a bold typeface, in a bold font, that reflects the Islamic scriptures. So if you see anything in bold, it's the Islamic scriptures. And then in a different font, a much lighter font, is my commentary on those scriptures. So if the Quran says that Moses was meeting with Pharaoh, and Pharaoh told Moses that he was going to crucify him. Now, I could just pass over that and say that's what the Quran says, or I could tell the reader that that's not possible, because Moses met with Pharaoh in about 1200 BC, and crucifixion wasn't even invented until 500 BC. And so throughout the this presentation, I do this kind of hold Islam accountable. They, for example, Islam says that Abraham and Nimrod were contemporaries, and that Nimrod tortured Abraham. Well, the fact of the matter is that we now have hundreds of thousands of clay tablets from Mesopotamia, and we know that Nimrod had been dead for 600 years before Abraham was born. And so in Prophet of Doom, I will present what the Islamic scriptures say, but I hold them accountable by providing the reader with historical insight. Sometimes I don't need to. For example, the Quran says that Alexander the Great was a Muslim, and that Allah tells a story about Alexander going to the place where the sun sets. The sun sets in a muddy spring. And that muddy spring is surrounded by extraterrestrials. And that Muhammad said that he went to visit those extraterrestrials, and they decided that they didn't want to become Muslims. And so there's certain things you don't need to comment on. Another is that the sun rides in a chariot. An eclipse is when the sun falls out of the chariot. It is a misfortune for the sun. And the sun gets back in the chariot by prostrating itself and showing obedience to Allah.
You know, Craig, it's very interesting what happened to Salman Rushdie, who was a Muslim himself, but when he wrote Satanic Verse, which certainly was nowhere as much of an expose as what you're putting out, why they put a contract out on his life.
Yeah, first, Satanic Verses is a novel. I don't think most people know that. And it's written actually for Muslims. Unless you knew Islam, you would never understand Satanic Verses. And Salman Rushdie was a bad Muslim, but yet he was, in fact, a Muslim, which is why the fatwa was put out on him. Any Muslim who rejects Islam must be killed. Now, Satanic Verses is a real event. Not only does the Quran talk about the Satanic Verses, in fact, Muhammad, the Quran says that Muhammad, like all prophets of Allah, spoke on behalf of Satan. But the Islamic hadith is fixated on the Satanic Verse episode. So what Salman Rushdie wrote about was not some imagination or some negative thing that he coined. No, it comes directly from the Islamic scriptures themselves.
I think, by the way, Stan may be getting at a point that was concerning me, too. Do you have any concerns that there may be some retaliation? I understand perhaps you're saying the kind of thing that was issued against Rushdie was designed for Muslims, but since they're not too hot on infidels either, do you have any concerns for your own safety?
Well, of course. When you do what I do, you recognize that you only have one chance of living, and my only chance of living is if I am providing a service to Yahweh, who is the God of the Bible, and fulfilling this mission of exposing Islam so that I might save Muslims from it. I don't hate Muslims. I love Muslims and want to save Muslims from Islam. I want them to know their religion as well as I know their religion. So long as I am doing that well, I believe that that Yahweh will keep me alive. When I am no longer providing a service, they will probably kill me. But
that's a little bit unnerving. How did you, to go back to your incident of meeting with the terrorists, how did it end? How did you, get out of there alive and be...
It's one of those great examples of when you're in a concrete bunker underground, surrounded by steel doors, and you're in a room that's got one, light that's dangling from the ceiling, and everybody is armed, and everybody hates you, and everybody is saying they're going to kill you, and yet you get out. In a car they're driving, and they take you to the border, even though you're at gunpoint the whole way, you got to wonder, why is that possible? Why did I survive it and Daniel Pearl not survive it?
Right.
And, I believe that I survived it because Yahweh had a mission for me to do, and I was willing to do it, and therefore it would have made no sense for them to be able to kill me. And I think that is why I'm alive to this day.
What do you think the terrorists attribute your being alive to? Why did they let you go in their minds?
Oh, I don't think they had any. I don't think they had any choice. I'm certain that they are disappointed that they allowed me to live, but I can't say that since they're all dead. The Fatah members aren't all dead, but the Al-Qaeda members, the Islamic Jihad members, the Hezbollah and the Hamas members are all dead.
Are any of the Hamas members ones who have departed more or less recently in this last round of Israel?
The last of them died almost 9 months ago.
Craig, as I hear you talking, and of course you point out that this really is a satanic movement, and of course Nazism is a satanic movement.
Yes.
And you are so right. In fact, everything going on has a spiritual connotation, and I'm really so pleased that you recognize this and you're helping to get that word out, because most people are looking at things from a historical point of view or a geopolitical point of view, but unless we address it from a spiritual point of view, none of it makes sense.
Yeah, what's interesting is no matter what point of view you address it, you come to the same conclusion. Historical point of view, doctrinal point of view, political point of view, you come to the same conclusion. But if you address it from a spiritual point of view, what you find is far more revealing. One of the things that I did not know, and to a large degree, I don't think I've ever heard any theologian ever talk about, is that now that I'm so intimate with Islam and so aware that the character that is ascribed to Allah in the Quran is identical to the character ascribed to Satan in the Bible. He leads men astray. He spends all of his time in hell. He predestines 999 out of every 1,000 people to be tortured. He participates in the tortures. He's very graphic in the tortures. The only thing that he promotes is war and killing, and it says that he is purposefully deceitful. But what I have found is that the Bible was not the least bit coy about Islam. Lucifer's name, that's the name of Satan. Satan itself means the adversary. But and actually the Hebrew word was Hillel. It became Lucifer in Latin. But Hillel's name, Lucifer's name, is only given one time in the Bible, and that is in Isaiah. And in Isaiah is talking about the all-Islamic war that's going to be launched against Israel in the end times. And in the midst of that, he then introduces, by name, the only one time in all 66 books in the Bible, Lucifer. And he identifies Lucifer as being the operative spirit behind Islam talks about using Gentiles, the prostration prayer, which is the signature move of Islam, and terrorism to subdue the Gentile world and to attack Israel. Then when you get into Paul's letter to the Corinthians, Paul says that Lucifer, he uses Satan because Lucifer's name is only used once, but he uses the adversary name for Lucifer, Satan. He says that he will impersonate an angel of light. See, the Quran is allegedly revealed by Gabriel. Lucifer disguised himself as Gabriel in his revelations to Muhammad. And Paul writes and he says that Satan will disguise himself as an angel of light to a boisterous messenger who is arrogant but has eloquent speech, who will call himself a messenger of God, who will bring a new gospel and will lead many astray. He's talking specifically about Islam. When we get to the mark of the beast in Revelation, again, all of the words are descriptive of Islam. The mark on the forehead is the prostration prayer. This is what Allah, who is Satan, says that he is the way that he goes about identifying his Muslims. A right-hander in Islam is one who goes to paradise. The left-handers are the ones that go to hell. The nature of Satan in the Quran is a weather god. The only miracles Satan provides, Allah, provides in the Quran are weather-related. He is the prince and the power of the air. His only miracles, his only power on earth, beyond seduction, is control of weather. It's the same spirit, and the Bible's very clear as to how Lucifer is going to use this prostration-oriented doctrine of Islam, this terrorist doctrine of Islam, is the way that it describes it, to lead men astray. And so, yes, I have. I am convinced. In fact, there is no other rational conclusion. But that Satan is a very real spirit, and that Islam is wholly satanic.
It's very interesting that the traditional Christian view is that there will be an army of 200 million attacking Israel in this. I'm not sure whether that's the battle of Armageddon.
No, that's Armageddon. Armageddon is not fought.
Right.
There are two wars in the tribulation. The first war follows the peace treaty by 2 years. It's fought, starts at year two, it ends at the halfway point, and it's the Gog and Magog war. Gog is a leader, Magog is a country. The country is due south of the Caspian Sea. It is in all likelihood Iran is Magog. And the way the Bible describes this World War III, which is the one that's actually fought.
Ezekiel 38 and 39 now.
Yeah, that's right. Gog and Magog. Right. But Isaiah, from the ninth chapter all the way through the end of the book, speaks of every single nation that will be involved in World War III. It talks about the United States in the 17th and 18th chapter. But it begins by saying that before all of this occurs, that this nation that is beautifully described as the United States, in my opinion, a land to the uttermost west of Israel, across the sea, that is known for its air and naval power, a fair-skinned people from a land divided by rivers, that this nation goes in against the uproar of the world into the realm of Babylon, to subdue terror, and it goes terribly wrong for this nation. This nation separates itself from Yahweh and gets pruned as a result. And then it goes from there, and it talks about how Egypt and Syria will do their normal thing, and they'll do the pincer attack on Israel. And this time, Iran, who will have nuclear weapons, will lead the rest of the Islamic world into Israel because the pincer attack will fail, as it always has. And collectively, the Islamic world will fail in its attempt to destroy Israel. But it's a combination of two things. One is God rains down Volkswagen-sized hail on the attackers as they come into Israel. And second, the Antichrist, who has set up residence in Jerusalem, will begin to use nuclear weapons. It says that one-third of the earth's surface is scorched beyond repair. And ultimately, in the war that is fought, World War III, the Gog-Magog War, one-fourth of the Earth's population dies. And it says that five out of every six of the attackers, which would be a billion Muslims and 500 million infidels, are going to die in World War III. Armageddon is the battle that has the 200 million men. The Euphrates River is dried up for the 200 men to march across it. And because Islam will have been destroyed, the only place left in the world that would have an army of 200 million men that would cross the Euphrates to get to Israel would, of course, be China. And so it's in all likelihood that's the Chinese. But that battle is not fought. That's the end of the seventh year of the tribulation, and the Messiah returns and says, enough already. Enough death and destruction. You guys are going to completely annihilate the planet. I'm in charge. And that's the second coming.
Well, these are exciting times we live in, Greg.
They are indeed. And the more one sheds one's ignorance, the more we're able to tell what is going to occur. Now, what's really interesting, Stan, and I'm sure you know this, this is one of the things that it's troubling, I think, for a lot of people. Because the Bible says these things are going to happen does not mean they are predestined.
If you want to change it, what would you do?
Yeah, right? Yahweh lives outside of time. It's kind of like, you know, if you're in a blimp above the Rose Parade, you can see the beginning of the parade and the end of the parade at the same time. But if you're sitting on the street like we are, trapped in time, you can only see the part that's passing in front of you. What Yahweh is telling us through his prophecy is, because I live outside of time, I'm going to tell you what the sum total of your choices is going to lead to. All the way through, we make the choice. We just make bad choices. And he tells us the ultimate consequence of our choices.
So you think that could be averted if somebody
absolutely
would get active about it?
Yes.
What would you say?
Let me give you an example of a place where it was postponed, if you will. When Jonah was asked to go to Nineveh, Nineveh was the baddest place on the planet. It happens to be, you know, where Iran and Iraq are today. And they were the same kind of people. They were terrorists. They were thugs. And God said, I want you to go there, and I want you to preach, and I want them to stop separating themselves from me. And so Jonah says, hey, no way I'm going there. They're terrorists. They're going to kill me. And so, you know, he went and set sail, which is the wrong way to go if you want to go to Nineveh. You don't go off in the Mediterranean. And that's when he spent the 3 days in the whale. But ultimately he went, and he preached, and they repented, and for 100 years Nineveh was spared. That was the Assyrian nation. The same thing could happen in America. If America would wake up and stop separating itself from Yahweh start treating false and satanic doctrines as they should be treated, we too could endure another 100 years. I don't believe we will. I believe that political correctness has so poisoned Americans' ability to think and to reason and to understand the forces around us, and that we are so willfully ignorant, and that we have for now 4 decades consistently separated ourselves from our Maker, that I believe that my mission is more of a Jonah mission than more of a Jeremiah mission than a Jonah mission.
But we're here to try, and we're here to do our best, and the results will be left up to the Lord.
That's correct. You know, and the reason I do what I do, and I'm sure, Dr. Stan, it's why you do what you do, is that while the Bible says what our choices are going to lead us to and the consequence of those, it does not say how many people are going to make the ultimate right choice. And the ultimate right choice is to choose to form a personal relationship with our Creator, to accept that gift of eternal life that was offered to us because of what Christ did on Calvary's cross. Because of that, we have the opportunity to live forever with our Creator. That is a choice that we get to make. And by helping to awaken America and by helping to save Muslims from Islam, millions may make the right choice and as a result spend their eternity with our Creator, not separated from Him.
Well, it's an interesting perspective that you spend your time, your risk in going into a situation like a meeting with a terrorist to try to bring about what you know, that's one of the interesting things about people and interesting things about America, that it will bring up some individuals like you or Dr. Stan who will put out huge efforts for what they believe in.
And well, you know, when you write a book, it's like dropping a pebble into a quiet pond, and all you see are the ripples going out. You never know where they end, but you never know who's going to be impacted by one of those books you've written, Craig. And so I'm really excited about them, and we'll certainly do everything we can to help you get them circulated.
Well, thank you, and it's, you know, it's such a pleasure to be able to speak with you, because we share a common passion to help save our country and save people that whether they be Muslims or atheists or agnostics or religious or whatever they may be, to save them so that they might live forever in the presence of our Maker.
One of the big problems we have today is that most Christians don't even know that there is a problem. Most Christians are so wound up in religion that they've lost sight of what Christianity is really all about.
You know what? Well, that's true. Let me give you a glimmer of hope. Last night I was on Art Bell's show. Art Bell went back and guest hosted Coast to Coast last night, and he, I think, is probably an atheist. But last night I was outspoken about how Christ was anti-religious and how neither Christianity nor Judaism are religions, and that I told the audience I work for Yahweh. I don't want anybody to be confused here. That's who I work for. And I got hundreds upon hundreds of emails today from people who said, "Thank you for having the courage to tell Americans that Christianity and Judaism are not religions and that God has a name." Hundreds of them.
By the way, would it be worthwhile for you to give that email address so that people can get in touch?
Oh, they
know how to get your books.
Yeah, they teawithterrorist.com is how they there's a feedback link at teawithterrorist.com. Teawithterrorist.com is a website that presents the books, and a whole lot of information on Islam as well, but it also has a feedback link, and that's how these people reached me following that program last night.
That's teawithterrorist.com.
Right.
Right. Well, I would urge people to look you up. I found you on Amazon.com and places like that as well, and go to teawithterrorist.com. It's extremely interesting.
And Amazon's a great place to buy the book. I mean, they just make things easy, and what you find when you go to a place like Amazon is the controversy. If you are an atheist or an agnostic, Tea with Terrorists will drive you absolutely crazy, because it presents God in an intellectual way that is very difficult for folks to refute, and so it really gets under people's skin, and so they just hate it.
Well, it probably drives them completely up the wall.
It does, because you know they're used to dealing with people who are or Christians who they could, you know, they out debate and out think, and one does not have to throw away one's intelligence to believe God. What I prove in Tewa Teras is that it actually takes a great deal more faith to believe that God isn't than to believe that God is. And the other half of the people that read Tewa Teras say that it changed their lives. It's one of those books that will guaranteed leave no one bored. And it has a very, as I think you know, Dr. Stan, has a very strong gospel presentation in the book that sneaks up on people that I think makes the agnostics and the atheists in the world that read it very uncomfortable with it, because in the midst of presenting Muhammad, since Muhammad was fixated on the Bible, I present the last 24 hours of Christ's life as a contrast. And I actually present it in the places where he spent those last 24 hours, because I was in each of those places. And I take the reader into what it was like to be the Messiah for the last day of his life and how he responded on our behalf. And it's a very moving experience, including to...
quite a creative writer.
Well, it wasn't. I had lots of help in writing it. What's most amazing about Tewa Teras is, while I probably know more about Islam now than any non-Muslim in the world, I did not when I wrote. I wrote Tewa Teras in 4 months, and yet there is nothing in Tewa Teras that is inaccurate on Islam. In fact, it is precisely accurate. That's not humanly possible. So I believe that while all the mistakes in Tewa Teras are mine, the inspiration in it is not mine.
Well, God works in a very, very strange way in between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity. There's an infinite quality of difference. Certainly God can direct you, can direct anybody out there in the listening audience who's
yes.
willing to give their life to him.
Yes, absolutely. What he can do with unskilled labor is amazing. And you know something? One of the things that I found is that I view myself as wholly unqualified in every respect in the world, and there's only two things that caused Yahweh to say, you know, I'm gonna do this with you. One was he asked and I said yes, and that probably is 90% of it. And the other is passion. He likes rascals. He likes people with passion, who are willing to be bold, to go out with enthusiasm, to love people enough that they're willing to become vulnerable. And I just think he likes rascals. So my qualifications are that I'm unqualified.
Well, some might dispute that about both you and Dr. Stan.
Oh, it's wonderful being unqualified and being reliant.
Absolutely.
That's what faith is all about.
Well, I would urge people to call Dr. Stan at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, get his book, Brotherhood of Darkness, get connected to Tea with Terrorists, and we'll come back with another interesting segment.
And I'm certainly looking forward to doing that program when we get the Prophet of Doom. Good night.
Absolutely.
God bless you.
Good night, everyone. Good night,
good
Dr.
Night.
Stan.
Night.
Thank you very much for a wonderful evening.
Thanks so much, Myrna. I really appreciate your filling in.
Oh, no problem at all. Anytime.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.